Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Despite spending his early political career as a European diplomat, Lord David Frost is now not the most popular figure in Europe. But was that his plan all along? I'm Jessica Elgott, Chief Political Correspondent of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
We have made progress in areas like trade, trading goods and services, transport, social security cooperation, EU programmes, participation and so on, which is good, but nevertheless big differences do remain.
He has a background in the Foreign Office, a department not exactly known for Euroscepticism, but David Frost was the man that Boris Johnson wanted as his chief negotiator for exiting the European Union. Now elevated to the Lords and with a plum cabinet job dealing with the fallout from Brexit, Frost continues to ruffle EU feathers, especially when it comes to sorting out thorny issues like the Northern Ireland Protocol. So who is David Frost? To get to know a bit more about him, I spoke with The Guardian's Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin, Matthew O'Toole, a former civil servant and a current SDLP member of the Northern Ireland Assembly, and David Hennig, the UK director at the European Centre for International Political Economy, who in a previous life worked with Frost. Well, first of all, thank you ever so much for joining me. And I guess, David, we'll start with you. You're probably the person who spent the most personal time with David Frost because you worked with him. How would you describe him personally?
I worked with him for 3 years between 2011 and 2014. Clearly, that was a lifetime ago in many respects. I'm not sure we knew that much more about him when we worked with him. He wasn't the kind of guy who was taking the team to the pub every day or was, you know, the heart and soul of the party. He was very much a civil servant of his rank. Clearly, we had a lot of dealings with him. He just struck me as a pretty typical senior civil servant. Got on with the work. Clearly, had his ambitions towards being ambassadors at various places then. We didn't know much about his politics. I knew he was right of centre. Is that unusual in a civil servant? Not necessarily. It's probably the minority, but not there are plenty of Conservative supporters there. But yeah, in terms of sort of flavour, no, I don't think we knew that much about him even then.
Jennifer, he's got a bit of an unusual path for Eurosceptic, hasn't he? He studied French at university, spent his early professional career in the Foreign Office, an ambassador in Copenhagen from quite a young age. It feels quite an unusual way to become a Brexiteer.
Yes, and certainly we don't associate the Foreign Office as a hotbed of Euroscepticism, quite the opposite. But it's quite an interesting question as to when David Frost did become a Eurosceptic, because by his own account, he dates his Euroscepticism way back to the early 90s when he was in Brussels working at UKREP on economic and financial policy for the UK government. And he says it's in this period that he started to become disillusioned about the EU institutions. He certainly kept it to himself, and people who knew him at the time, people who knew him, for instance, when he was ambassador to Denmark more than 10 years later, didn't pick up any hint of any Euroscepticism at all. So it seems that if he was a true Eurosceptic, it's something he nursed in secret until he left the Foreign Office in 2013. And even as late as May 2016, shortly before the EU referendum, he was extolling the virtues of the EU single market. That was when he was in charge of the Scotch Whisky Association, and he was very happy to talk about the importance of EU food and drink regulation and how it's helped Scotch whisky makers sell their products all over the world. So then the nature of his Euroscepticism is a bit mysterious, and certainly he's either it's something he's kept very quiet to himself over many, many years, or it's something that's evolved in the much more recent past.
Matthew, you worked when you were working in Downing Street. How much was David Frost on the radar? How much was he influential? He wrote a pamphlet, I think, about how to negotiate, sort of in the context of David Cameron's renegotiation. Was he seen as a kind of guru, or just not really on the radar?
I mean, I don't think he was. In a sense, his career is kind of the opposite of Boris Johnson's, in that Johnson is someone who, about whom there is some doubt about the deep sincerity of his Eurosceptic views, and whether they, how substantial they are, and whether they're just simply they had been a means to advance him at a particular moment or set of moments in his career. And he's performed them very publicly and very theatrically, whereas David Frost obviously has, in a sense, had the opposite. It seems that he's had the opposite experience, where his Euroscepticism is something that has been, he claims, there all along. But he was, as the others have said, a kind of model of a technocrat on the surface.
Let's talk a little bit about him and Boris Johnson, maybe David and Jennifer. Obviously, they probably met during that time they were stationed in Brussels in the 90s, and he seems to be a bit of a kindred spirit with Johnson. He seems to be the only person left in Downing Street now who he really trusts, deeply trusts. But he's not, that their personalities don't seem very alike. He's much less flamboyant. And as you say, Johnson seems to have principles that change like the wind, in a way that David Frost has led, sort of guided him through his career. Why do you think they've become such kind of firm allies?
So I think that one of the aspects of being a senior civil servant that people don't realise is that you have to be good at giving messages to ministers in the way they want to hear them. That's vital to their progression. And clearly David Frost was good at that. I believe the two of them got closer when working with alongside each other at Open Europe before the referendum, and before either of their Euroscepticism had become quite so strong and obvious. And I think that Frost clearly, I think, did his civil service number of telling Johnson what he wanted to hear, but also showed a bit of flexibility. So I imagine that Boris Johnson didn't expect to hear this from David Frost. So in a way, Frost is sort of playing Johnson, telling him things that he doesn't expect from a civil servant, and that helps to bring them closer together. He then becomes Boris Johnson's spad in the Foreign Office, where, let's face it, Boris Johnson was not necessarily universally popular. So Frost may have seemed at that point to be the ambassador or the ex-ambassador he could trust. I just think that for whatever reason, David Frost has been able to communicate with Boris Johnson, and that I've heard from people at pretty close proximity, that's genuine. Boris Johnson really does respect David Frost, what he says, and David Frost obviously works hard to make sure he's saying the right things.
Jennifer, set the scene for us in Brussels when it emerges, when Boris Johnson is clearly going to be victorious in the Tory leadership election. We've been through a tumultuous Brexit period where everyone's completely lost faith in Theresa May's ability to pass any Brexit deal. And, you know, it emerges that David Frost is going to be the negotiator, going to be the one trying to salvage a deal. What's the reaction there?
Initially, Brussels was rather flummoxed by David Frost. They really didn't know what to make of him, because he was sort of less than a minister, but more than a civil servant. If we go back to the period when he was appointed as chief negotiator in 2019, and the EU is a very sort of protocol-bound place. So there were questions about, you know, was he the equal of Michel Barnier, the EU chief negotiator? Was he a David Davis, or was he more of an Ollie Robbins, Theresa May's chief negotiator? They really didn't know where to place him. But I think it became clearer in February 2020 when David Frost gave a speech to the Free University of Brussels, where he set out his thinking And this was an extremely unusual speech for a civil servant to make. It's not just a statement of government policy, and it's unimaginable that his predecessor, Ollie Robbins, would have given such a speech. So I think then that they realised that they were dealing with someone who really was Boris Johnson's envoy and had Boris Johnson's confidence. But at the same time, they found him very difficult to deal with. He would go to the negotiations and he would simply just repeat and repeat that the UK was a sovereign country and that he couldn't agree to what was being discussed. And this cycle went on for months and months. And I think in comparison to previous negotiators, they found him very unconstructive and difficult to work with, although there was eventually a deal, but that was a deal that was unlocked by Boris Johnson himself choosing to compromise. And we didn't see any sign of that from David Frost in the negotiating rooms.
Matthew, tell us a bit about his relationships, I guess, we're both with Dublin and also in Belfast. This was about around the time that the relations with the DUP were disintegrating. And how much was David Frost a player in that?
Since the deal was done, the withdrawal agreement, I'm not aware that he spent very much time in that period between July 2019, when he came into office with Boris Johnson, and the end of the year, whenever the deal, or the autumn, I suppose, when the deal was concluded and then was able to be ratified following an election. I'm not aware that he spent very much time on the island of Ireland or on Irish issues generally. I do know that subsequently, and particularly this year, with the protocol having been implemented, he has spent more time here, particularly in Northern Ireland. And I have to be honest, his role has not been particularly constructive. It seems to have been, rather than to explain and help bed in and make work the deal that he was obviously responsible for concluding, he has, I think, encouraged certain groups in the idea that this deal is fundamentally objectionable and can be picked apart. I think that comes back to both his own preoccupation with the concept of sovereignty rather than the practice of sovereignty. And one of the most creative practices of sovereignty for the UK has been to find a creative solution to Northern Ireland, but also his, I think, not particularly deep engagement with the challenge of the historic Irish question.
David, do you think it's the case, and he's almost sort of said this publicly, hasn't he, that he viewed the Northern Ireland Protocol as just something to be got over with and done and dealt with afterwards once the deal had been passed? And that's sort of still how he views it, isn't it? He in an announcement in recent weeks that he views it as that, and he, you know, just can be something that's renegotiated now that we're out of the EU.
Well, the Northern Ireland Protocol was clearly not David Frost's choice of how to handle Northern Ireland and Brexit. Up until really a week or two before Boris Johnson had his chat with Leo Varadkar, the government and David Frost were putting forward a completely different set of proposals that were all about open borders. They were still really working hard on alternate arrangements. My view with David Frost is what you see is the real truth. I think he genuinely thinks that the EU is overreacting, does not really need to protect its single market in this way. Northern Ireland isn't so much of a problem. As such, what we see then is just a sort of repetitive situation towards Northern Ireland. So there's just a fundamental mismatch going on there.
Jennifer, he's clearly going to, for some time to come, be a fairly major player in Boris Johnson's government. He's got this cabinet ministerial position now, which he managed to extract after that power struggle in number 10, which saw, you know, Dominic Cummings depart and him, you know, we hear, threatened to go but stay because he keeps this very, very large influence. You know, for those torrid years, 2016 to 2019, it felt like Brexit was almost impossible to achieve. Actually, leaving the EU was impossible. Does he deserve some credit for being the negotiator who did make it happen, ultimately did deliver on what the referendum said?
Well, I would say that Brexit was never impossible, but it was impossible on the terms that had been promised by the proponents of Brexit and Boris Johnson first and foremost. So the deal that eventually emerged is very much on the sort of scale of deals that were always possible. I mean, we should really talk about two deals because, of course, there was the divorce agreement and the eventual trade and cooperation agreement. And I don't think you can really see David Frost's fingerprints over the first part, over the divorce deal. And clearly he's unhappy with the Northern Ireland Protocol, as we've just discussed. And when it comes to the trade and cooperation agreement, yes, he was the person on the spot who delivered that, and you could point to more particular things that where the UK gained, perhaps for example on getting particular concessions on electric cars, to choose one example. But I think the overall outcome of Brexit is very much within the realms of the possible, and was something that you could have charted out a few years earlier, given the red lines the UK set up from the very beginning of this process back in 2016.
Matthew, clearly David Frost's reputation, I think it'd be fair to say, is still riding pretty high with Tory MPs. He's still seen over this side, or you know, within the Palace of Westminster, as someone who got the deal done, who sort of ended the moment of kind of national collective breakdown. Do you think that the Northern Ireland Protocol could still undo that reputation? Could it still be something that really undoes all of that reputation?
It depends on whose judgment you're asking about, Jess, I suppose. First of all, if it's the judgment of Conservative backbenchers, then it may be that at some level he and Boris Johnson feel that the low level or even high level confrontation dispute with the EU is at some level kind of good for the reputation among a certain type of the Tory backbenches. I mean, in terms of his relationship with the protocol and whether he makes the protocol work, I have to say, I mean, I'm fairly, obviously now I speak not just as a neutral commentator, as a participant in this, I'm fairly sceptical as to the view of the current crop of Conservative backbenchers, with some decent and honourable exceptions, it has to be said. I mean, his reputation certainly should, if he cannot find it within himself to resolve his issues with the European Union and to make the protocol work in a sensible way, then it should damage very profoundly his reputation. It's also worth saying very briefly, some of what David Frost done this year has been, I think, in itself destabilising. He seems to be determined to create a narrative around deep societal and political unrest. They've almost become a stakeholder in going to the EU and saying, look at the problems you're creating. That, I'm afraid, is deeply, deeply irresponsible. So if that continues, rather than just resolving the protocol and making it work in a way that's pragmatic and practical, then I don't think the judgment will be particularly kind to him. Whatever the views of Tory MPs are, a very particular and possibly quite unrepresentative audience.
David, I'll give the final words to you. What do you think David Frost wants his legacy to be? What's his ambition? What comes next for him?
I think David Frost thinks that he is going to resolve the UK's relationship with the EU as the lead negotiator. I think he's seen this opportunity come by, and I think we'd all take this opportunity. A lot of people have said of David Frost that he may be motivated by what happened previously in his government career. Sure, well, now he's trying to put it right. And there is that great fear, I think, among a lot of the people who are watching at the moment, that he's almost like the gambler who keeps chasing after losses. That's the fear, is that he really wants to make all of this work. He's promised the Prime Minister he's going to make it work. And in doing so, he will, as Matthew just put it, almost make it worse. And then he's going in danger of becoming more and more stubborn. So no doubt he sees the opportunity, and I think he sees the his chance to really resolve this relationship. There's a lot of fear that he's not quite in the right place to deliver that. I think September is going to be rocky.
That was fascinating. Thank you all ever so much for joining me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And that's all from us this week as we bring an end to our summer series. Make sure to listen next week as we get ready for the end of recess and the start of conference season. But for now, I want to thank my guests, Jennifer Rankin, David Hennig, and Matthew O'Toole. The producers are Yolinga Fan and Danielle Stevens, and I'm Jessica Elgott. I hope you're enjoying your summers, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.